Good evening. Welcome to Left, Right and Centre. I'm Vishnu Shom. On the programme tonight, the Centre's One Nation, One Election push has been strongly opposed by the opposition, which wants to have nothing to do with it, not even the panel under former President Kovind, which is looking at this issue very closely. Now, the Congress believes the committee's results are a foregone conclusion. One way or the other, this is a fascinating proposal. If implemented, it would rewrite the way our democracy works. But it is also clear that implementing a change so big will require amendments to many laws, and that'll be very difficult to get done. On the show tonight, a sensible discussion on One Nation, One Election and its profound implications. And at half past the hour, everything you want to know about the G20 process. On a day when China made it official, Xi Jinping will not attend the G20 summit in Delhi. Their premier will. But is this necessarily a setback for Delhi? We'll be looking at that very closely. Also, traffic concerns, airlines and flights. What will be open, what will be shut during the G20 days later this week? We'll bring you all of those details, try and give you as many answers as we can. But the big question is the BJP's decision to pursue One Nation, One Vote. How significant is it? Is it a political masterstroke? Let's go across to Dr. S.Y. Qureshi first, the former Chief Election Commissioner of India. Thanks, sir, very much for being with us. In fact, I'm just trying to look at it both from a constitutional perspective and a legal and political perspective as well. But let me stick with you, sir, to some of the legal arguments and the constitutional arguments. And the first one is this. Given how difficult it is to implement this, and that there will be multiple amendments which will be required, realistically, can this happen in a finite period of time?
Yes, you know, this proposal has been on the table for good 10 years or even more. Prime Minister, when he suggested it, he requested for a debate. He didn't thrust it on the nation. And that debate has been going on. And meanwhile, at least three committees have looked at it. First, the Parliamentary Committee in 2015, then Niti Aayog, then the Law Commission in 2018. And they all found some problems with it. There are some benefits. Actually, there is no right or wrong answer. There are many benefits and there are many problems and questions. So, first of all, the reason given for simultaneous poll were three. One, that it costs a lot of money repeatedly and the money will be saved. Good point. Then the work paralysis, they say that because of the model code of conduct and prolonged elections, multi-phase election, normal activity of the government comes to a standstill. And he says the politicians, the party workers' time is spent. So that was the other thing. Now, these are the serious concerns, but we can look at them through an alternative route also. Now,
tell me one thing, sir. State and assembly elections were concurrently held once in the 50s and in the 60s. Why should that not be renewed?
Exactly for the reason why they were discontinued then. Because originally it was thought, even the Constituent Assembly considered it, and they thought that elections will be held once in 5 years, and they even discussed whether we should even have a full-time CEC. And finally, they agreed as a compromise formula that at least one officer has to be there, so let there be a one-member commission, which is the CEC, because you know they have to update the rules, and there could be some by-election because of some death or the resignation. That's why. So, but then why did it happen? Not 66, but in 57 itself, the communist government was dissolved.
Right.
And midterm elections were held. And after that, the governments have been falling regularly here and there and now and then. That situation will still continue.
Okay, so next question is this. Will One Nation, One Vote prevent massive election expenses, which is presently the case, and will it bring down the security requirement massively as well?
Well, in the sense that since the elections are held repeatedly, the expenses are incurred by not only the election management, the election commission, but by also by the political parties and the candidates. That is true that it is done repeatedly. But in fact, there is another disadvantage which they was not mentioned, that before every election, there is a spurt in casteism and communalism and electoral corruption. So more elections means we are always in the hate-mongering mode, polarizing mode all the time. So it will be a good idea that if elections are held once in 5 years, at least for 5 years, there will be peace in the country. Now, what the other side is, that the expenditure can be brought down by an alternative route. 60,000 crore was the estimate by CMS, Center for Media Studies. If the ceiling is imposed on expenditure by political parties, you know, there is an expenditure control by law on the candidate. You can't spend, for instance, in Lok Sabha more than 80 lakhs. 1 rupee more and you will be disqualified. But your party can spend 8 crores, 18 crores and 80 crores. So that makes mockery of the expenditure ceiling because it disturbs the level playing field.
Sure.
And the poor will have no chance. Now, if we put a ceiling on a political party expenditure also, immediately from 60,000 to it will come down to 6,000 crores. And we have this arrangement in UK from whom we borrowed the electoral system. So let us look at that possibility. Secondly, prolonged election.
Yes.
It can be reduced. Elections have been held for the last 20 years in 6-7 phases, at least in some states and in national election, only for one reason, to save lives. And it was found that every political party demands that we bring paramilitary forces from outside. Their number being limited, so we had to rotate those forces from one phase to the second to the third and fourth. If more forces can be given in the first place, from 2.5-3 months, it can be brought down to 30 days, single phase election, which in any case is a better idea in the context of the social media. Because by the time our force moves from one phase to the other in 3 days.
Yes.
For in 3-4 hours, the gundas move from one phase to the other. So actually, it is getting neutralized. So single phase election will be good for everybody, will bring down the cost. It will reduce the dislocation of the normal activity, which was one of the causes. Therefore, we have to see the...
All right, we need to look at it. Sir, next question to you. Do you believe that simultaneous polls will blur the lines between national and regional issues?
Absolutely. Absolutely. In fact, you know, all three tiers of elections are equally important. You would notice that sometime in the debate, initially the proposal was that all three tiers could be held together. Later on, we stopped talking about the panchayat elections. We talked of only two tiers. And the three committees I talked about, they said, okay, even that is not possible once in 5 years. So let us do it twice in 5 years. So with so much of dilution, there is hardly any moral authority left in the proposal.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah. And in any case, I'm very happy that this new committee in the terms of reference, they've talked of all three tiers. So let us see. Now, the point you made, panchayat election is as important constitutionally as Lok Sabha election.
Yes.
And if I'm living in a village, for me, the local drain and Anganwadi and primary school and dispensary is more important than our policy towards Ukraine. So why should the issues be mixed up? So local elections should be based on local issues, the national elections on national issues, state elections on state
But does
issues.
That line get blurred, is my question, sir.
Yes, definitely.
If you have, right, and that's, yes. So therefore, it's not a good thing for our democracy, is it?
Yes, it is not, because the line gets blurred and there is a proof. There was a study done for 15 years from 1999 to 2015 when simultaneous election to the extent they are held, where Lok Sabha, 4 or 5 states go to poll together. And okay. It was found when they were held together, 77% voters voted for the same party.
Right.
And okay. When they were 5-6 months apart, it fell down to 61%. And when it was 8-10 months apart, you have seen what happened in Delhi.
Yes.
Entire lot went to one party for Vidhan Sabha, another lot next election, every vote went for another party for parliament. So obviously the voter behavior is affected.
Sure, that is certainly a
foolproof. Yes.
Right. All right, sir. Wonderful speaking to you. Thanks so much for sharing those thoughts. Let's bring in the politicians now. We're joined by C.R. Keshavan, BJP spokesperson, Charan Singh Sapra of the Congress, Neerja Chaudhary, the senior journalist. She's not a politician by any means, but she certainly knows a thing or two about how politics work in this country. So again, you know, basic questions, and then we'll get your answers to that. So C.R. Keshavan, to you first. You know, a lot of people are asking questions on the timing of this. And it's not that anybody suggests that this can happen overnight, but still the timing is being raised. And therefore, the question is this. Is the BJP's decision to pursue One Nation, One Vote a reaction to recent assembly poll losses?
Vishnu, I'd like to recall what the Prime Minister Narendra Modi ji said in 2020 in the 80th All India Presiding Officers Conference. He said, given the frequency of the elections, this comes in the way of developmental work. And this is not just a subject of deliberation or debate. He said it's a need of the nation.
Yep.
The first thing we have to understand is it's not being, you know, brought surreptitiously or furtively or being thrust. This was there from 1952 to 67. And if first we have to see the origins, and the viewers have to know why this stopped. Because the founding fathers, if you see, like Qureshi ji was saying, if you see the constitutional debates, you'll have extensive debates. Be it uniform civil code, adult franchise, but there was nothing on one poll, one nation, because they never thought such an assault on democracy or a constitution would happen like it happened in the 60s. See, if you see the first time 356 was imposed by Indira Gandhi as Congress president was in 1959. Then from 1966 to 1977, 39 times, you know, the governments were toppled. And please remember that in 1970, the first time ever, a parliament, a Lok Sabha was dissolved by Indira Gandhi in 1970. And then more importantly, if you see, everybody is doing a brouhaha about constitutional amendments. People, youngsters of this country have to understand the kind of diabolic and deadly assault Indira Gandhi did on the constitution with emergency. Vishnu, 42nd amendment ensured she, because her government had to continue from 71 beyond 76, she changed the tenure of the Lok Sabha and the assemblies to 6 years. People don't know that. This was the same Congress party which is trying to save
this
democracy.
This is all historical fact. But my question is this.
My question, I'm addressing this. See, this is, like Qureshi ji said, the Prime Minister had spoken about it in 2016, 2019. It has been in the BJP manifesto in 2014 and 2019. If you see the Election Commission annual report in 1983, they said we should start going back to this. 1999, Jeevan Reddy ji, you know, okay. The law commission says...
Okay, got it, Mr. Keshavan.
So,
I take your
I
point.
I want to sum up by saying one thing. You see the Congress party. You know, neither anything, one nation, you know, they don't have, they're one alliance, don't have one neeti. Mr. T.S. Singh Dio, the deputy chief minister, says it's a great idea. Samajwadi Party in their alliance says this should have been done in 2000.
Okay, so let me get a response from them.
It is a good thing for the country.
Now, Mr. Keshavan, I need to keep the strike rotating now. I will come back to you in just a few moments. Charan Singh Sapra, why don't you react to some of the points that he says? It is a historical fact that in the past, in the 50s and the 60s, we had elections at the same time. What is necessarily wrong with this? Or is the arithmetic planned by the India Alliance profoundly affected by this debate?
See, Vishnu, the BJP should also remember that India in 1970 was different, and India in 2023 is different. The population at that time was less, and now the population has crossed 140 crores. And similarly, the number of states in 1970 were less, and now the number of states have increased. So the calculation that Mr. Keshavan was giving, those are historical facts, 1970, 71. And let me also mention that the 6th Lok Sabha or the 7th Lok Sabha or the 11th, 12th, 13th Lok Sabha, they were all curtailed. They were all terminated before the tenure could get over. So this is the political system which is being followed since many years. And it won't get settled by only pointing out at Srimati Indira Gandhi. This is the demography and the democratic system. Now, by bringing in one nation and one election, I feel this will harm democracy. This will harm constitution. This will harm the constitutional procedure, which is already set. This will harm the federal structure. They need more than 5 constitutional amendments. And to get those constitutional amendments, they also need the participation of the states. Ratification from the states is also required, at least 50%.
Yep.
And we have seen the 3 reports which have come. All the 3 reports, they have shown the demerits of this one nation, one election also.
No, there's a committee now formed. Yes. You have chosen not to be a part of it.
2018, the report which he gave, I'll take 10 seconds. That has shown all the demerits of this also. So one has to go through that. Government cannot take such a big decision in haste.
No, but they're not taking it in haste. And yet the Congress Party chose not to be a part of the committee headed by the former president of India. You say it's, the conclusion is foregone. But then why don't you be a part of it still, even if you think that? Shouldn't you have a voice in the process? You've been invited to have a voice.
Yeah, I'll answer that. Vishnu, the kind of committee the government has made, I feel that does not suit the kind of disruption which is going to happen. You have only one legal luminary in that to explain the legal process. You have kept a former leader of opposition in the committee of Rajya Sabha, but you have not kept the current leader of opposition of Rajya Sabha in the committee, Mr. Kharge. So this clearly shows that this committee and the terms of reference of the committee are predetermined.
Okay.
And they will be going towards the BJP or Narendra Modi.
Okay. All right, Mr. Sapra, you made your points. Let me come across to Nija. Nija, just analyzing this going forward, given the fact that the BJP has had a couple of assembly election losses, and they still depend very heavily on the image of Narendra Modi, will simultaneous polls ensure a Modi versus who situation? In other words, the leadership of Modi in national elections, which is the BJP's strongest card, if it is also more effectively replicated at the assembly election level, you're basically handling 2 scenarios with one leader and what he represents. So for the BJP, is that the strategy?
Well, in the short term, it could help, but Mr. Modi is not going to be there forever. So when the party, I somehow don't think that it is only the immediate. It could be immediate considerations, could be a part of why they are going for it now. But I think it goes beyond that. They obviously feel, and the debate, I agree, has been going on for a long time. It sort of surfaces and then goes on the back burner again. But we have to look at the pro. There are the pros and the cons. And I think it would be a very good thing if enough time is given to discuss it all over the country. And the states become part of that live, vibrant discussion. Of course, there is the whole question of, money. But then our democracy cannot be weighed against only money. Money is the dominant consideration. Mm. There is the whole question of governance going on the back foot because you have election after election every few months. So there is, of course, merit in that argument. But on the other hand, what you have said yourself and what has come up in this discussion is that will the regional issues, the local issues take a back seat? And for a country as diverse, as plural as India, something we are all very, very proud of, is that a good thing? It is a very loud democracy, cacophony of democracy, again, which we talk about and say we are proud of. And the federal spirit, what happens to it? If national issues will dominate in panchayat elections, and to say that people will make choices, of course, people do make choices one way or another for national, something different, for regional, something different. But it does become very, very confusing to have 3 sets of elections simultaneously.
Sure.
I would say one more thing lastly, Vishnu, which comes to my mind. How will the ordinary people of India react to the idea of their leaders coming to them only once in 5 years? They love it when leaders go to their homes, haath jod ke mangte hain. That's a time that the voter feels I'm the king. And that, I think, will they like it? I don't know.
Let's get Mr. Keshavan on this. I think it's a valid point, Mr. Keshavan. We are used to our political leaders coming to us every couple of years, one election or the other. If they come once every 5 years, is that what people across states really
let
want?
Me, before I answer your question, Vishnu, I'll answer the Congress spokesperson. He should first read up. In 2015, a parliamentary committee, it was headed by Mr. Sudarshan Nachiappan from the Congress. And it very clearly said, not only this is paramount and important, one nation, one election. If India needs to compete on a real-time basis as a robust democracy with developmental work of other nations, it is a must. This was said by Mr. Sudarshan Nachiappan, head of the parliamentary committee. Mm-hmm. And also what is, you know, completely befuddling is Mr. Adhir Ranjan Chowdhury agrees to be on the 9-member committee. And then he does a flip-flop. God knows who gave him pressure, because the government has very clearly said that they took his consent before the notification was issued. So he was also on board, like T.S. Singh Dio. So that I want to place on record. And one more thing. See, this is not just for parliament and assembly alone. It is also for municipality and panchayats. And that's what the terms of reference say. Mm-hmm. So let us look at one precedent, Vishnu, just allow me. The Prime Minister introduced one nation, one tax. These people, went to the Supreme Court. It was, ruled in the favor of GST. And see the transformation. You're the fifth largest economy with a $3.75 trillion, GDP. One nation, one ration card. Please understand that 81.35 crores, 813 million people are being given ration, and migrants from anywhere during the perilous pandemic were able to go and get ration. And you talk about one nation, one constitution, one nation, one flag, abrogation of 370 in Kashmir. There is vibrant democracy. You've never seen it. One nation, one civil court. This was mandated by the Supreme Court to be a constitutional expectation. So one nation, one election, which has been bequeathed to us by our founding fathers and mothers, will not only reduce cost, it will make us focus on developmental work, it will increase voter turnout.
You make your point very eloquently. C.R. Keshavan, you make your point. Mr. Sapra, I think the big takeaway from what he's trying to say is that focus on the job at hand, running the country, various projects. He's given examples of projects which have worked well. If it is more unified, why are you opposing it?
See, when Mr. Keshavan is mentioning 2015, then I would like to say that why then Narendra Modi government has waited till now, till the fag end of 2023. That means the timing is a big question over here. They want to divert the attention of the whole nation from the major narratives of the people. The major narratives today are inflation, unemployment, women empowerment. These are the major narratives where BJP doesn't want to answer. China, they don't want to answer. Hence, they are trying to deflect it. Now, number two, I'm coming to your point. Let the BJP also answer when there will be an election in the midterm tenure. What will happen? Will the state, suppose a state government is dissolved or there's a no confidence motion within 1 year? What will happen rest of the 4 years? Will it be the president rule, or if the central government?
So that's a valid point, Mr. Keshavan. Everybody has that question.
Yeah, let me answer that, Vishnu.
Mr. Sapra, let's get an answer to that one question. Quickly, Mr. Keshavan.
This is the problem with cursory reading. Please read the terms of reference of the high-level committee. What does the committee say? You will look at situations like hung assembly, hung verdict. You look at situations like a no-confidence motion. You look at situations like a defection. This is not, cursory like the Congress party is looking at. There are very senior people, including President Kovind, and these people are going to analyze.
But Mr. Keshavan, what is the answer to that question? State governments collapse for one reason or the other, without getting into the reasons, if they do.
Vishnu, you and me are not on the committee. The people in the...
I am asking you for your opinion. But do you not accept it's a valid argument or a valid question?
Did anybody say, when you look at the Law Commission's recommendations, what does it say? It's a very good idea, but you need changes in electoral reforms. You need changes in constitutional provisions. These are all set by the Law Commission. This is not like do it in one go. All situations are going to be analyzed. And they are going to come up with solutions.
Mr. Keshavan, let me just quickly try and get an answer to this question.
You and me can't sit in a debate over 30 minutes and decide how law is going to be made.
I'm asking you whether or not it's a valid question. Let me ask Nija, is this something that concerns you as well? What happens if a state government collapses? Then the entire routine of one nation, one election goes for a toss.
Absolutely. And the whole idea of a fixed term. Suppose the government is terrible. It's very corrupt. It goes for loot. It's not accountable. What do? You are stuck with fixed term. Those are questions that are not answered.
Right.
The answer will come when the report comes out.
No. But Mr. Keswan, the whole idea of, what is the idea of a debate? To raise this question. It's not that you tell 8 people, they are going to decide, the rest of us are going to keep mum.
You can always go to the committee. This is a democracy where the government...
But we can also speak on a television report. We can also write about it. We can raise questions. Why not? What's wrong with that? Why should only it be left for 8 people?
No, but Mr. Keshwan, it's a valid question. That's all that we are raising. We aren't questioning the outcome of this of the COVID committee at all. We don't even know what the report is. They've not started working on it. So I think it is a valid question.
It's not just a question. There are so many other angles you have
to look at. Okay, but Mr. Keshwan, why don't you answer the question which Mr. Sapra did raise? He raised questions on the timing, right? He said that if you had planned it earlier, why didn't you try and get it done earlier? So what's your answer
to that?
Can
I just say one thing? The Prime Minister in 2016 raised it. Mr. Sapra should know. In 2019, the Prime Minister called an all-party conference of 40 parties. 21 parties, including the Samajwadi Party, attended to say it has to be implemented in 2019. So it's not that the government has introduced it overnight. It's been in the manifesto. The Prime Minister spoke about it in 2016. He called an all-party conference meeting in 2019. And then in 2020, the Law Commission has recommended it. So it's a process. If you go and listen to Mr. Qureshi Vishnu, he has said that over the past decade, this has been discussed time and over.
Yeah,
so the question is, what Vishnu, Mr. Sapra is raising is as dubious duplicity as the Congress is known for.
Okay, one sec. Let's get Mr. Sapra in for the last comment. Just to be fair, sir, you've got about 30, 35 seconds. Mr. Sapra, please go ahead. Yes.
Vishnu, I feel this one nation, one election is going to largely boomerang like it happened in land acquisition bill or maybe the farm laws with the government bought in, because here they are not consulting the stakeholders. Why the government is not consulting the state government?
No, but sir, respectfully, you've got it wrong over there, Mr. Sapra. You were invited to be part of the COVID committee.
No.
You chose not to be a part of it.
No. It's not about one committee. I am saying there should be elaborate discussion with all the
Vishnu,
political parties.
Did the government say that it is going to implement it in this session?
With this kind of committee, the government...
One second, Mr. Keshwan, let him make his point. Yeah.
This will lead to dictatorship in the country. That's what I'm trying to say.
Government,
if you really believe in democracy, you need to consult the stakeholders. Okay. You need to discuss.
Okay, fair enough. There needs to be a larger process of consultation.
This is pure bunkum.
It is going to come up in Parliament. It is going to be discussed in Parliament. So I think the process of consultation not happening, perhaps that's not correct either. But we leave it over there. And I'd like to thank you all very much for joining us. It is absolutely fascinating. What will this mean for our democracy? If it's implemented, it's not going to be soon. It's going to take a large period of time. And is it good for us? So you've heard a cross-section of views over there. We're going to take a short break up after that. This is India's G20 presidency. This is very much the G20 week. Saturday and Sunday is when the big G20 summit here in Delhi. 15 heads of state are going to be over here. Some of the world's strongest and most important leaders. China will not have President Xi here. Their premier, however, will be here. We'll be decoding G20 for you throughout this week, including our special segment up after this. Good evening and welcome. It's the final countdown for the G20 summit in New Delhi, with 15 top global leaders set to arrive here. This is India's G20 presidency. The scale of the event has been truly huge, but it all boils down now to the final statement expected over the weekend. While there are sharp differences over Ukraine, there does appear to be a great deal of mutual agreement on a host of themes, from sustainable economic growth to financial inclusion to fighting cybercrime to digitalization. The big development today, the Chinese Premier Li Qiang will attend the 18th G20 summit in Delhi this weekend, but not China's President Xi Jinping. This was not entirely unexpected, and as we shall explain, not necessarily a setback for the host India. We'll also try and explain what G20 is all about, and since many have questions on traffic and other restrictions in Delhi, we'll bring you some key questions and answers. But first, the G20 is a huge process. How does it work? Parmeshwar Bawa has the details.
Let's take you through how the G20 works. Well, processes under G20 are divided into two parallel tracks, the finance track and the Sherpa track. Now, the finance track is led by finance ministers and central bank governors of member nations who meet throughout the year. Meanwhile, the Sherpas oversee negotiations all through the year, discussing agenda items for the summit and coordinating the work of the G20 as well. Now, working groups designed around specific themes operate within both tracks. These include representatives from relevant ministries of member nations and invited guest countries too. Various international organizations like the United Nations, the International Monetary Fund, and the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development also participate in working groups. Now, you know, issues discussed by G20 leaders have broadened in recent years, from just economics to include issues such as climate change, sustainable energy, international debt forgiveness, and taxing multinational corporations. Basically, every year, a different G20 member state takes over the presidency and sets the agenda for the meetings. This year's working groups have covered topics like financial inclusion, digital economy, the environment, as well as climate sustainability. Now, it is a big deal because, as you know, G20 members account for more than 80% of the world's GDP, 75% of global trade, and 60% of the population of the planet. Now, for the selection of the presidency, the 19 countries are divided into five groups, each having no more than four countries. And the presidency rotates between each group. And every year, the G20 selects a country from another group to be president. India is in Group 2, which also has Russia, South Africa, and Turkey.
Well, China's President Xi Jinping will be skipping the G20 summit, not entirely unexpected. But China's Premier Li Qiang will attend the Delhi G20 meet. That has now been announced. So Li will lead the Chinese delegation at the Delhi G20. Let's take a look at how Chinese state media announced the absence of Xi Jinping and the presence of Li Qiang.
欢迎出席今天的外交部例行记者会。首先，应印度共和国政府邀请，国务院总理李强将于9月9日至10日出席在印度新德里举行的20国集团领导人第18次峰会。
I am disappointed, but I'm going to get to see him.
Thank you. Well, the absence of heads of state from China, Mexico, and Russia at this year's G20 summit is not particularly unusual. It's not unusual per se, in fact. From 2008, there have been 16 physical summits of the G20 and one virtual summit. Out of these 16 physical summits, except the first three summits in 2008 and 2009, there's never been a single occasion from 2010 till now when every country has attended at the head of state or head of government level. Six times there has been one country below the level of head of state or head of government. Five times there were two countries before below head of state or head of government. One time there were three countries below head of state or head of government, by which I mean none of these leaders arrived. There was representation at a junior level, possibly at the foreign minister's level. One time, there were six countries below the level of head of government or head of state. That was in 2021. So as you can see over there, it is quite clear that it's not entirely unexpected. And Mexico's president has, in fact, not attended a G20 session since 2018. Joining us now, Ambassador Manjeev Puri, India's former representative to the United Nations in Nepal. Thanks, sir, very much for being with us. How significant is China's Xi Jinping not attending for us here in India?
Vishnu, thank you very much, and thank you for having me on your program. Look, I think we have China there. The Prime Minister will be there. So as you've said, in the past also, there have been countries which have not been there at the head of state or government level. I think we should acknowledge that had President Xi himself been there, it adds a little bit to the presence of a country which is truly a heavyweight in global terms in this G20 thing. But, you know, it isn't unexpected, and you yourself have highlighted this. There are several reasons, among them, you know, our bilateral issues, etc. Having said this, I think that the way things have progressed is that we have made substantial progress on pitching for things which are important to the Global South. And I'm sure in those, in various ways, we shall have the support even of the Chinese.
Do you believe, sir, that you know China increasingly finds itself somewhat isolated in key international fora? For example, in Hiroshima, G7, they were not invited. They did not attend. Over here, they have chosen themselves not to, to send in Xi Jinping. You know, there's been this recent issue of them releasing this map of theirs, something we don't accept at all. We, of course, have the Quad grouping, which works, and in a sense, against Chinese expansionism. There's AUKUS, which, of which we are not a part, but which does the same. So therefore, at one level, do you believe, certainly in the Asia-Pacific region, there is a sense of China being increasingly isolated?
So Vishnu, I am not able to hear you very clearly, but you know, I think President Biden, when he said there is a sense of disappointment, of course, this is something we all need to acknowledge. But having said this, you know, I can only repeat that we do have the Chinese at the level of their prime minister who represents China in several of these multilateral bodies. Now, therefore, China is there. President Xi is not there. It does make a difference. But, you know, on the other hand, the G20 is about collective action. And that collective action certainly comes about by the presence of the Chinese at the level which is extremely high, their prime minister, as well as the presence of all the other major economies in the world. Let's note, we have Foreign Minister Lavrov representing the Russians, another major country in the world. And this is not the first time it has happened. He was there even at Bali. So it's the question of getting the countries and the countries in their entire heft behind the positions that the G20 takes for global good, for the betterment of humanity, if I may say so.
How significant would the absence of a joint statement among G20 leaders be? Because I ask this because the issue of Russia and Ukraine has been something where there's been no consensus.
So, Vishnu, let me put it like this. The G20 is not a treaty-based body. It is an organization where countries come together. They decide that either they will act nationally in consonance so that there is a global push, or alternatively, they make a consensus so that at the relevant de jure bodies, the treaty bodies which deal with a particular subject, the largest and most important countries will push in a particular direction so that de jure decisions get taken. I believe, despite the fact that, you know, this entire business of geopolitics, the West saying that without Ukraine, without those issues, it's very, very important, even in terms of geoeconomics and the global economics order, and our and many others believing that the G20 is truly an economics forum and not about geopolitics. I think the fact is that if we get these countries together on several of these critical agendas, especially those that are critical for the Global South, we would have made significant progress. And I refer to debt restructuring, for example, the digital public infrastructure, climate, finance, reform of the MDPs. I look at all of these, and of course, the life agenda, women-led development. I look at all of these as positives, and where the largest and most important countries in the world actually are on the same page.
Ambassador, just be with us for a moment because we'd like to talk to you about one more aspect, which is we have a package first. One of the most interesting aspects of India's G20 presidency is how it's become an all-India affair with meetings being held across the country. In fact, hundreds of them, as my colleague Maria explains.
The Prime Minister, members of his cabinet have all been saying that India's G20 presidency is a people's presidency.
G20 ki hamari presidency. पीपल्स प्रेसिडेंसी है जिसमें जन भागीदारी की भावना सबसे आगे है.
सो हाउ डिड इट बिकम अ मिशन फॉर 1.5 करोड़ इंडियंस हु वर इन्वॉल्वड इन दिस ईयर लॉन्ग G20 प्रोग्राम्स. 220 मिनिस्टीरियल एंड वर्किंग ग्रुप मीटिंग्स वर हेल्ड इन 60 सिटीज एंड दे वर नॉट जस्ट द मेट्रोज बट इन फैक्ट टू टायर सिटीज ऑफ इंडिया. 25,000 delegates participated in these pan-India events. India did not have a Delhi-centric approach, showcasing its vibrant cultural diversity and putting other Indian cities on the world map of diplomacy.
60 cities of India have hosted G20 meetings. I think no other country in the G20 has even come close to that record.
The third tourism working group meeting in Srinagar hosted 60 foreign delegates. It was one of the biggest international events held in Jammu and Kashmir since the abrogation of Article 370. While China skipped the meeting, officials from G20 members, which included Australia, Canada, France, Germany, Japan, South Korea, Russia, the UK, the US, and the European Union, all of them attended the inaugural events on the banks of Dal Lake. Varanasi hosted the culture minister's meeting. Delegates, in fact, saw India's oldest city and also the Ganga Aarti. Just to recall for our viewers, this isn't the first time that Prime Minister Narendra Modi has attempted to make a shift in what was earlier Delhi-centric diplomatic approach. Now, perhaps it is all of India. In September of 2014, Prime Minister Modi had hosted Chinese Premier Xi Jinping in Ahmedabad. Remember that image of the two leaders on the traditional swing on the Sabarmati riverfront? In fact, in 2018, it was Mahabalipuram which played host to Xi. The world's biggest cricket stadium in Ahmedabad played host to the then US President Donald Trump in 2020 with a big rally dubbed as Namaste Trump. In October 2022, India and the United Nations launched Mission Life, characterized by a three-pronged strategy for collective climate action. Among the G20 members, France, the UK and Argentina have also extended support to Mission Life, and India leveraged its presidency to win the support of other members in this grouping. The Voice of the Global South Summit, in fact, saw the participation of 125 nations and reflected India's desire to actively engage the Global South. Just a quick recap for our viewers on what is G20. The G20 was in fact founded in the aftermath of the Asian financial crisis, and members represent around 85% of the global GDP, over 75% of global trade, and about two-thirds of the world population. Unlike the United Nations, the G20 does not have a permanent secretariat. Its presidency rotates annually among the members, and the presidency is responsible for bringing together the G20 agenda, organizing its workings and hosting summits. The last presidency was with Indonesia, from where India took over in December 2022.
Ambassador Puri, this is interesting because, you know, it's not just Delhi and Mumbai, Kolkata, etc., where, we've had these meetings. It's been held in Lakshadweep, Arunachal Pradesh and Kashmir as well, besides dozens of other places. And this was the effort from day one. So I think that's important, you know, to send the message that India is larger than just our national capital.
Vishnu, absolutely. Look, let me use this expression, democratization of the G20, inclusive, making it a people's affair. So let me point two sides to it. One, the people of India across the length and breadth of our country have felt that we are doing something which has hugely raised India's global profile. Can you imagine being a citizen of the country, not just in Delhi, but in faraway smaller cities, and getting the feel that my country has come places and it's going places? My prime minister is going to be chairing a meeting of the leaders of the world. How nice it is as a feeling. Just think about that. That's one side of it. Secondly, look at who all have noticed. People from not just the 20 countries which form the G20, but about 40 odd countries in all, with guests and members and leaders of international organizations, all going across the length and breadth of the country and seeing how the G20 agenda is reaching out and how this global and local interface is being stitched together. You know, this is a game-changing thing, even for the G20, where earlier meetings used to be held either in resorts or in one or two major cities, and that was it. We have also gone further than just the geography. A host of organizations in India have been roped in to do G20 events. These include think tanks, it includes the youth associations, women's research bodies, all kinds of institutions. So there is a kind of embrace of the G20, and in a sense, it is India coming of age in a very big manner, and with the people of India also embracing this, let me say, huge upward step up by India, the country.
Ambassador, thanks very much for speaking to us. I'm sure I'll be speaking to you over the next couple of days as well. Thank you very much indeed. Well, Delhi's all set to host our guests with the final heads of state conclave. That's going to be held over the weekend here in the national capital. Lots of preparation. In fact, the principal secretary to the prime minister was at the technical airport of Delhi's Indira Gandhi International Airport. There'd be dozens of VIP aircraft which would be coming in. Therefore, security, all important. And we'll be bringing you many more details on that as well. My colleague Nita Sharma joins us for more on this. So, Nita, will there be a large number of flight cancellations? And how are we going to be handling all of these VVIP movements from the air?
See, Vishnu, Delhi is all set to roll out a red carpet for all its world dignitaries who are arriving in Delhi for G20. We are being told that the Palam Technical Airport is going to cater to all the VVIP flights. As many as 70 planes carrying all the world leaders are going to land there, including Air Force One. As far as Air Force One is concerned and a couple of other flights, they are going to be parked at the technical airport only. Rest of them are going to be parked at Delhi Airport, Bay 1 and Bay 2. When I spoke to the DIAL authorities about those cancellations, they said not many cancellations have taken place. About 200 flights have been cancelled, and these are small flights which thought they don't have enough passengers, so might as well cancel those flights. As far as arrangements are concerned, Delhi Police, including all the agencies, sister agencies, have made a mammoth kind of arrangements, a deep arrangement have been made, starting right from the technical area to whichever area these VVIPs are staying. The US president is staying at Morris Sheraton, which obviously we know is at Sardar Patel Marg. Why that has been chosen? Because on the right side, Vishnu, there is the Intelligence Bureau headquarters. So obviously that area is well guarded, and that is why all the American presidents obviously stay there. Rest of the dignitaries are staying in most of the hotels in New Delhi only. Again, the New Delhi district is going to be no bar zone as far as the normal movement is concerned, but all those essential commodities can be fetched, and all those movements would be allowed. That's what the Delhi traffic police is been saying. So huge arrangements are there. The Indian Air Force is also on alert. Any kind of aerial movement would be banned starting from September 7th. 4 airports have been kept under the reserved category. So if there is any problem at the Delhi airport, so the flights can land at these 4 airports, which includes, Indore, Jaipur, Chandigarh, and also Lucknow. So these 4 airports have been also kept on high alert. Vishnu?
Right. Nita, thanks very much for sharing those details. Well, in their quest to make the mega G20 summit an unqualified success, authorities in Delhi are taking a series of steps, from decking up the national capital with nearly 7 lakh ornamental plants to painting underpasses, bridges and pillars, to a lot of high security.
Over 1,000 special commandos spread across the capital. Chopper landing drills on hotel tops and paramilitary preps at key locations. The national capital has turned into a fortress for the big G20 finale that will see more than 15 heads of state in Delhi in the largest and grandest G20 summit ever. As we travel through the decked up lanes of Delhi, with final touches now being given, a glimpse into the mega makeover ahead of the summit next week.
I come to you from right outside one of the entry gates of the Grand Bharat Mandapam, where the G20 Heads of State Summit will be hosted in just days from now. And here you can see final touches are being given right outside. The G20 banner has been installed here as well. A new fountain as well has been installed, especially for the G20 Heads of State Summit. In fact, there you can see how PWD officials from the national capital also supervising. One important aspect of India's G20 presidency has been to showcase our rich cultural past to the world. You can see all these walls, this is a railway underpass. They've been adorned with paintings of various historical books like the Ramayana and Mahabharat. In fact, not just its cultural past, but also the fact that India has advanced technological systems in place as well, whether it's dams or tunnels, they've also been showcased here. And a key part of Modi's cultural diplomacy, a key part of foreign policy. Well, right outside Terminal 3 of the Indira Gandhi International Airport, posters and banners have been put up. This is the approach road to Terminal 3. Of course, heads of state will be travelling, traversing this road to reach the Lalit, the Taj and the venue of the G20 Heads of State Summit as well. An important focus has also been rebuilding of roads, approach roads particularly. This has been done at a staggering cost of lakhs of crores of rupees in the past couple of months, in fact. There you can see workers are constantly working in the heat.
Very, very happy to say that 98% work has been completed. More than 100 fountains have been set up.
Okay.
Around 70-75 artifacts have been set up, and the roads have been repaired, footpaths have been repaired,
okay.
Green patches have been developed, and more than 6 lakh spots have been put up,
okay.
Both side roads,
okay.
To give a festive look.
Okay.
And you can see this, now we are going to, you know, adorn the trees in this fashion, these trees in this fashion also,
okay.
So that the when the guest arrives in Delhi,
yeah.
They should get a feel that Delhi is the most beautiful city in the world.
Delhi is the most beautiful city.
At the Taj Palace and the Lalit in Delhi, grand presidential suites getting ready to host top world leaders. Special chefs have been brought in to put together a lavish spread.
पिछले छह महीने से हम जो तैयारी कर रहे थे कि मिलेट का तड़का हम अपने विदेशी मेहमानों को कैसे परोसेंगे तो उसी के ध्यान में रखते हुए मैंने कुछ डिशेस बनाई हैं जो कि पूरा का पूरा मिलेट रिलेटेड है आप ये देखिए यहाँ पे एक फ्रूट सलाद है जिसमें कि मैंने पूरा मिक्स का मिलेट का तड़का यहाँ पे दिया है
अच्छा।
आप उधर वहाँ पे जापानीज है मेरे पास जो कि शिराए सैलेड है उसमें पूरा मिलेट ड्रेसिंग बनाया है मैंने जो यूरोप में एक काफी फेमस डिश है जिसका नाम लज़ानिया है उसमें भी मैंने एक मिलेट का तड़का लगा के दिया है
20,000 delegates from 19 member states, special invitees, over 40 heads of delegations. The largest ever G20 will be held at the Grand Bharat Mandapam in the heart of the national capital. This is India's big global moment as the leader of the G20 and the voice of the global south. In New Delhi with camera person Kanan Patra, Vedant for NDTV.
And we'll be continuing with our special programs ahead of the G20 summit over the weekend. For now, it's time for this short break.